It is a great pleasure and a great honor to be invited to talk to this meeting on quantum foundations. Since quantum foundations is an avocation of mine, and I would say a passion of mine, but not an area that I've most contributed to. So I'm very glad to be allowed to present some results and a point of view here. I also want to thank Yakir for the inspiration. You wouldn't remember, but we met in Avner Shimoni's class when I was a graduate student at Boston University. Certainly you don't remember, but I remember. You came and visited a class of Avner Shimoni that I was in. The point of view of the talk that I'm going to present, the work that I'm going to present, is rather old-fashioned. There are, one might say, three roads to the foundations of quantum mechanics. One road, which has been prominent here at this meeting, is to discover and develop and explore new quantum phenomena. This is what Yakir's contribution has been, and to puzzle us with new puzzles and new paradoxes and resolutions of paradoxes in the hope of understanding quantum mechanics more correctly. I wish I could pursue that road, but I'm not so clever. I get confused too easily. The second road, which is really the dominant road these days, especially with the influence of quantum information theory, posits that quantum mechanics is essentially correct, or at least mandates that we'll consider quantum mechanics as correct. And if we're still confused about issues like the measurement problem, it says the problem is our mode of thinking, the problem is our thought, and seeks to find better ways of speaking about quantum phenomenon to make us more comfortable with things that used to puzzle us, like the measurement problem. And that, of course, starts with Bohr and complementarity and so forth, and in a sense continues today with modern quantum information-based approaches to quantum foundations. The third approach is the oldest and is really goes back to Einstein and Schrodinger and de Broglie and all those people who contributed to the invention of quantum mechanics but never believed it. This is to take the point of view that we're puzzled about quantum mechanics because the theory is incomplete. It's useful, as Einstein said. It's a great tool to predict the probabilities for certain kinds of experiments, but it's not a complete description of nature, and to seek to complete quantum mechanics and find a complete description of nature that quantum mechanics would be an approximation to. That's the tradition that, being old-fashioned and not clever, that I from time to time pursue. And I want to show you one approach to it. I know what Bill said. I wasn't there, but I've heard the parts of the talk before, and I disagree with you. But I understand that you had that argument. For me, the Bell theorem plus the experiments tell us that the world is fundamentally non-local, and we live in a very puzzling natural world in which there's a lot of characteristics of locality, like propagation of information, propagation of field equations. And there's a lot of non-local correlations and non-local observables, like the modular observables, that yield real information about nature. So I take non-locality as fundamental to nature. Not only that, I situate everything that I do in the framework that of the lessons that I think we learned from general relativity, which is that space and time are relational, that they're not a priori. Locality, therefore, is also not a priori. Locality is an aspect of relational. When I say relational, I mean what's fundamental is some dynamical network of relationships, as Leibniz imagined, that evolves in a time which is just a measure of change, and space is some emergent, approximate description of some dynamical network of interactions and relationships, from which, at the scales that we appreciate the world, space is emergent. But if space is emergent, so is locality. And if locality is emergent, then there can be modifications, distortions, dislocations of locality. And I take it that the world is probably awash in non-locality, And it's just, this is the point of view, say, of Anthony Valentini and other people who pursue, and I don't have to be a Bohmian to see the wisdom of that lesson. The world is awash in non-locality, which is hidden from us by the nature of the quantum statistics and quantum fluctuations. But if we want to complete the picture that quantum mechanics gives us, we have to discover that non-locality. And I'm going to make a big proposal about how we're surrounded by non-locality. Here is a Julian Barber-esque, and indeed it was inspired by conversations with Julian Barber a long time ago, relational Machian Leibnizian view of locality. If I am near Steve, we look at the universe and we have a view of the universe. But when I say the view of the universe, I mean the information coming to us up our backward light cone. Some bits of information on a two-sphere representing the directions in our backward light cone. That's my view of the universe. If Steve and I are near to each other, we have a similar view about many things anyway. We look out and we have a similar view of the universe. And that's because we're nearby in space and in space-time. But there's another way in which two systems can have a similar view of the universe. If they're very small microscopic systems, so the view of the universe is very limited to a small region near them. And if they're in situations that are similarly prepared and they're in similar environments, then they also will have a similar view of the universe. And my proposal is to take locality as consequence as a consequence of having a similar view of the universe. So Steve and I can interact because we have a similar view of the universe because we're nearby in space, but there's some Steve prime at the other end of the universe who also has a similar view of the universe, and Steve prime and Steve and I interact as well.
Lee prime.
What?
Lee prime.
Yes. So the proposal, which is starts off as vague and science fiction-y, and I'm going to put some mathematics to, is that whenever two microscopic systems are similar enough in their environment and their preparation, they're in some kind of interaction. Now, what I'm going to do is posit that the quantum state is a description of an ensemble, but not some imaginary ensemble, but an ensemble of systems which are similarly prepared in similar environments and therefore are in interaction. And I'm going to make a hypothesis as to what those interactions are and how to describe them in a certain mathematical framework. And I'm going to derive from that quantum mechanics as an approximation to the description of the statistics of those ensembles. In particular, from that interaction between similar but distant systems, I'm going to derive the Bohmian potential. So that's where I'm going. Did I say everything on this slide? I think so. So how did I get to this crazy point of view? I got it by contemplating Leibniz's identity of the indiscernible, which for me is a heuristic principle. It says if there are any two events or systems with the same relations to the rest of the universe, with the same, in other words, relational properties, because to a relationalist like me, all properties are relational, then they are the identical system. There are no two systems with the same set of relations to the rest of the universe. That's Leibniz's principle. And you can argue that it's been an extremely fruitful principle for physics. It underlies the symmetries of special relativity, Mach's principle, the use of the Hall argument of Einstein to find out that active diffeomorphisms are gauge invariants and so forth. And I'm going to use it in an even stronger way. One of its consequences is that global symmetries are not fundamental. Global symmetries are always approximations. And indeed, general relativity, this is the theorem of Karol Kukoc, has no global symmetries. Then there's more blah, blah, blah that I'm going to skip. But there's a particular blah, blah, blah that we came upon in work with Marina Cortez that is a consequence of the principle of the identity indiscernible, which to me is very striking. Consider two events which are characterized by their causal pasts in some network of causal relations. And supposing they have the same causal past, so they have the same view of the past, or isomorphic causal past, then if the principle of the identity of the indiscernible is true, they must have different futures. So there can't be, by this principle, any deterministic local laws. Because if there were deterministic local laws, if you had the same causal past, you would have the same causal future. So the world has to be, there has to be some randomness or some statistical uncertainties or fluctuations in evolution in the world, taking Leibniz's principle seriously. And that, I'm going to argue, is quantum statistics. Okay, I'm almost done with the blah, 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 which you may be hoping that the talk ends soon because the blah, blah, blah is outrageous. But I'm going to start behaving like a real physicist and formulate some ideas mathematically. But first, I want to discuss four principles from which my reformulation of quantum mechanics is going to come. First, goes without saying, I think, if you're a sober cosmologist, Neil may disagree, but neither of us are very sober cosmologists, which is that quantum cosmology is a kind of silly thing to do. Quantum mechanics... Sorry, I have to be straight up about this. I invested decades of my working life with the Wheeler-DeWitt equation in quantum cosmology, so I think I earned the right to say that. Quantum mechanics, to me, and I could base a talk on arguing this, but let me just take it as a statement that the rest is based on, is a good description of a small subsystem of the universe that is prescribed by the preparation of a system and the measurement or the post-selection of a system. Every time Yakir talks about post-selection, I think that tells me that I'm doing a finite description of a small subsystem of the universe. That's where quantum mechanics makes sense. If we want to make a cosmological theory, we don't want to just extend quantum mechanics to the universe as a whole. We want some other theory which extends to the universe as a whole, from which we can derive quantum mechanics as an approximation. And that is, has to go without saying, that's the presumption of the next three principles. Otherwise, they wouldn't make any sense. The second hypothesis or principle, the real ensemble hypothesis, I already said it, so I'll just say it precisely. The quantum state describes an ensemble, but not an imaginary ensemble as we use in statistical physics, or as Einstein, I think, imagined, but a real ensemble, that, by which I mean every single element of that ensemble is a physical system that lives somewhere in the universe. And the ensemble that I'm concerned with, if I have a particular atom, say, in a particular ion trap, is all the atoms or ions in similar situations, that is, subject to similar potentials and therefore similar Hamiltonians and similarly prepared wherever they might be in the universe. And I'm going to posit that the quantum state is a statistical description of that ensemble. What if, what if the system is unique and there are no such copies elsewhere in the universe? For example, you and me and my cat and your dog, which are big enough and complex enough not to be duplicated elsewhere in the universe. Well, then there's no ensemble and then there's no quantum state, and that's the solution of the measurement problem. The quantum state only describes systems which are small enough and elementary enough that they exist in many copies. Now, Tim.
So you said that they have similar Hamiltonians, but then you derive later the Hamiltonian from maximum variety in the ensemble. So is that, are you making, are you assuming an answer there, or is this
I'm using an informal concept of similar, which I then assume, and then I construct a model which assumes that I have defined such an ensemble. I wouldn't take that model back and try to use it to define my notion of similarity. Let me address this at the end, but I'm using an informal notion to define a physical concept, which I'm then making a model of. So it plays the same role as measurement and preparation play in more conventional formulations of quantum mechanics. It's an informal concept that defines an experimental situation that allows me to go ahead. So I go ahead. Okay. Locality, I've said the third principle comes from similarity of viewpoints, and I've said that. Yes, David.
Maybe you'll go on to this too, and so I shouldn't ask it now, but just very briefly, just to make sure I'm understanding what you're saying. I mean, of course, in ordinary quantum mechanics, systems can be entangled with one another, even if they're very different. I mean, the usual example.
Oh, yes, but the interaction that I'm going to be positing is not entanglement.
Well, yeah, but if it's going to explain how non-locality arises in quantum mechanics, then it's going to be intimately connected with entanglement.
So system A is a subsystem of system B. System B is a subsystem of system C. At what level of description or compositeness do I define my ensemble? I have to answer that question. The answer is the largest entangled subsystem. So I take subsystems as entangled systems as wholes and look for copies of them with the entanglement. And let me put the mathematics on the page and you'll see how that works. Okay. My fourth principle, is the principle of maximal variety, which is an attempt with Julian Barber to concretely parameterize what you mean by what Leibniz meant by similarity, identity, variety, and so forth. So the idea is I have a system which has subsystems. Think of a graph. And a subsystem of an element of the graph, in fact, I'm going to give you a picture. Think of a graph and think of two points of the graph. Think of the first neighborhood as going one step in the graph and taking the elements this system is connected to, this red one up there. The second neighborhood as being the points you get to in two steps and their connections. The third neighborhood, the points you get to in three steps in the neighborhood. Consider two points in the graph. Call their distinctiveness the smallest number of steps you have to go out to the smallest neighborhoods, which are distinct. So if the first neighborhoods are distinct, then their distinctiveness is one. You have to go to the second neighborhoods to be distinct, the distinctiveness is two. Take those distinctivenesses, sum them up over all pairs, and that's the variety. Actually, I said that wrong. Take one over those distinctive numbers, sum them up, and that's the variety. So the easier it is to tell where you are in the graph, the easier it is, the less information you need to know where you are in the graph, the more variety the graph has. And that's the formula that defines it in terms of the distinctiveness, which is one over these neighborhoods. So graphs like that have high variety. Graphs like that, it has to do with evolution of genetic regulatory networks, have high variety. Lattices and graphs with a lot of symmetry have low variety because you have to go out to the boundary, if there is a boundary, before you can distinguish nodes. So now I'm going to take that notion of variety and define it to configuration spaces that we might use in some kind of dynamical system. So I'm going to first of all define my viables, since this is ultimately going to be a completion of quantum mechanics. Our system is an ensemble consisting of n similar subsystems. N is going to be very large. Each subsystem has a d-dimensional configuration space, the point of which is a viable XA, A is the dimension, and K is the subsystem. And we'll assume for the purposes of this talk that they live in a vector space. You don't have to assume that, but it makes the math simpler. Assume that. And conjugate to that, we need some momentum. And this is where, without thinking about it, I took inspiration from Yakir and his friends in this meeting, was the momentum information is going to be in a phase. And the reason I did this is that I got tired of inventing hidden variable theories that collapsed because the wave function that I developed ended up being real. If you follow, say, Nelson or other attempts to make a dynamical formulation or a hidden variable theory of quantum mechanics in which the wave function psi is the square root of some probability density times e to the is, then you know you decompose into equations for rho and s. You forget that s comes from a phase. And you find out that you don't really get quantum mechanics back because you forgot that a phase was a phase. This is called Wahlstrom's objection. And I got tired of doing that, so I said, darn it, I'm going to just start with the momentum related to a phase. So whenever I point to a phase S, I'm really talking about a complex number at a root of unity W. And so there's one complex phase associated to every system in my ensemble. And that's where the momentum information is going to lie. Okay, so this is more blah, blah, blah. The subsystems are similar systems with same blah, blah, blah as before. But I want to mention that the math that I've come up with is equivalent to another recent formulation of quantum mechanics called the many universes formulation, according to which the universe comes into lots and lots of copies, and the quantum state represents an ensemble of those copies. Only in my case, the ensemble represents copies of systems that really exist in one universe rather than another universe. But the math turns out to be the same, and I stole a bunch of stuff from them, from Wiseman and friends. So now I formulate my blah, blah, blah in terms of these configuration spaces. Given two points, two subsystems, Vi and Vk in the ensemble, they have a point x and xi and xk, and I take the difference between them and call that the relative coordinate. And I divide that by the Euclidean distance between them, and I cut that relative coordinate off at some scale r. If two subsystems are further than r apart in their configuration space, I neglect the pair of them and the computations I'm going to do. Okay.
Is the phase hidden in V or not?
Oh, the phase is not here. This is totally, I'm playing with the configurations. This is strictly the configurations. I then define the difference between two views of the subsystem I and subsystem J being a sum over subsystems K's, the difference of the relative coordinates between K and I and K and J with the Euclidean norm squared. And I sum over all of those to obtain the variety V, which is the sum over all the pairs I and J of this thing that measures the distinctiveness of the pair. So it's the same thing I did with graphs, only I'm using Euclidean distances rather than counting neighborhoods. I just rewrite it. There are two sums involved, sum over I and J, and then there's a sum over K as well, and I just reorganize the sum. Okay. Now, I'm going to consider my ensemble, each element of which has a usual Lagrangian, that is the usual kinetic energy minus the usual potential energy, and I'm going to add to that Lagrangian this variety of the whole collection of subsystems, the sum ensemble of subsystems. So I'm throwing this in to what is otherwise a bunch of n independent systems, independent identical systems. I'm giving them an interaction between each other. And it's an interaction between each other that, with the sign that I chose, wants to make them not similar. It wants to make them move apart in their relative configuration spaces. So it wants to increase the variety and increase the distinctiveness. And in particular, you're not going to have two configurations sitting on top of each other because that would have infinite potential energy, because I take the potential energy being the negative of the variety. And I throw in an h-bar squared over 8m, a 1 over n cubed to normalize the scaling with n, and some other constant a to pick up some other factors that I'm going to have to pick up and dispense with. Now I deal with the phase degrees of freedom. I need to write the kinetic energy. The kinetic energy is a momentum squared over 2m. And I'm going to get the momentum from differentiating the phase s as usual. The momentum is the gradient of the phase. But I'm going to do it in such a way that I sum over all, to get the kth momentum, I sum over all j over all subsystems. I take the distinctiveness vector, and I multiply by the log of the ratio of the two phases, wi versus wj, and just take that as a definition of a relative notion of momentum between two subsystems. And I sum that up over all pairs, and that gives me the kinetic energy. Now it's getting a little bit technical. It's not blah, 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 and I don't want to snow you with technicality, so I hope the blah, blah, blah was interesting enough to get us through a few phases, a few slides of technical stuff. So the action is technical looking. I add to it something which is basically this relative momentum times x dot, or rather the relative momentum dot times x. That's the collection of symbols that turns out to be minus the Hamiltonian. The Hamiltonian has the potential energy, I'm sorry, the kinetic energy, which is the momentum squared over 2m. The new kinetic potential energy, which sums over all pairs of the subsystems, and the usual potential energy, which is local. And that's a dynamical system I study. That's a classical dynamical system, very weird, lots of non-local interactions, but it's basically a conventional classical dynamical system with lots of non-locality in it. I derive quantum mechanics as an approximation to that to large n. And I'm going to give you the high points of that derivation, and then if in the question session and somebody really wants to see the details, I have 12 pages of details, which, if you, you know, be careful what you wish for. So I have a bunch of points, n points in a configuration space, and I need to get out of that probability density on configuration space, rho. So this is a very conventional thing. I have a function phi on the configuration space. I define its expectation value to be the average over the points representing the different members of the ensemble. And I replace that average by an integral of the property phi times the probability density rho. That's perfectly conventional. I do the same thing for double sums. I have to have some properties phi of two configurations, xk and xk plus I, and I replace that by an integral over probability distribution with an offset. Again, this is, okay. This is just translating sums over members of an ensemble into a probability distribution. I'm happy to point. Now, in the integral over the configuration space, which is representing these sums, I have to remember that really n is finite and the system is finite. And therefore, there's a lower cutoff A, which says you can't get too close. And A is 1 over the 1 over dth power of the probability density times 1 over the 1 over dth power of the number n. 5 minutes, perfect. And that's just conventional stochastic mechanics. This is I'm emphasizing what's conventional because I'll underline what's unconventional. But really, this derivation is perfectly conventional stochastic physics. I then have a large scale cutoff as well, R, okay, because if I had infinite systems, I would have divergences all over the place, and I don't want to have divergences all over the place. So I cut off my large scale, I say if two configurations are too far apart by some scale R, I'm not going to count them. And I'm going to scale R like 1 over n to the 1 over d. And so there's going to be some R prime, which is going to be held fixed, and some large scale and configuration space is going to be held fixed. And we can keep our eye on it. And that's a little less conventional, but it's necessary to get the results in a simple way. So there's my Hamiltonian. And my claim, and there's a few pages of calculation that give you this, is that when n is large, it reduces to this, which are a function of the phase S. Every time I write S, every time I write derivative of S, it's really derivative of the phase W divided by W, or times W inverse. If I write S, because that's conventional, a term in derivatives of the probability density squared. Anybody recognize that? That's going to give the quantum potential when you differentiate it. Stuff of order, that should say 1 over r prime, and stuff of order 1 over n. And that's the red arrows to show you where those three terms come from. You have to deal with the symplectic structure, the thing which is p dot x. Why is it not x dot p, by the way? Somebody asked me that in the question session, if you like. That's a long story about an idea called relative locality, about why p dot x is more fundamental than x dot p. But it turns out to be helpful here to take p dot x, where p is that relative momentum. And then the symplectic structure, the p dot x, turns into rho s dot. So the phase is conjugate to the probability density. For people who have been playing with quantum mechanics, that's not a surprise. You get rho dot s, or rho s dot there. So putting everything together, you get to leading order in 1 over n, an action principle. It depends on rho and s, which are two functions on the configuration space of this large ensemble. You find the critical points. You differentiate. You get two equations, a rho dot equation and an s dot equation. And again, it's no surprise to people who've been playing with quantum mechanics that those are the real and imaginary parts of the Schrodinger equation. So that's my reconstruction of quantum mechanics. It's a leading order in 1 over n. Some comments, and then you tell me when to sit down.
Don't sit down.
I lied at one step that I have to be honest about. Rho of x is the ensemble probability distribution. Rho k of x is the probability distribution for the kth subsystem. I want to get quantum mechanics for the kth subsystem. I want to say that I reproduce the Schrodinger equation for one of these guys. I don't care about the statistics of the whole ensemble because I only have one atom in my atom trap that I'm studying. So I have to assume that the specific probability for any subsystem converges to the probability for the whole subsystem. In other words, that's an ergodic hypothesis. I have to assume that there's enough of these non-local interactions that they bring these different probability distributions all to be equal to each other, equal to the global one. And I don't know how to show that. So that's a hypothesis. There's a story about quantum statistics. Basically, if I assume that I have identical particles, then rho and rho dot should be symmetric under exchange of any of the coordinates. And that implies that I have conventional quantum mechanics, which either bosons and fermions by the conventional argument. I think I'm going to stop here. There's more things to say, But I want to emphasize that this is, I want to claim a solution to the measurement problem, because the answer to why you and me and your measuring instrument and your cat and my cat don't live in superpositions is that the quantum state description only applies to systems that come in large number of copies. There's some other dynamics which applies to systems that are unique, and we have to go back to the fundamental theory and study the consequences. Now, let me just end with a challenge, since there are good experimentalists here. This idea could be easily falsified. All you have to do is invent in your laboratories a quantum system which is sufficiently complex that is has a number of entangled qubits in it of sufficient complexity. There's a good argument that it doesn't have any natural copies anywhere in the universe. And then the claim here is that it would obey evolution laws different from the Schrodinger equation. And we can figure out what they are if you want to do the experiment. So by testing how the Schrodinger equation, whether a system which is complex enough to be unique in nature, whether it really obeys Schrodinger evolution, you could easily falsify this idea. And I'll stop here. Thank you.
Please. Yes, please.
So, on your last point, people are trying to build quantum computers to have large states of entanglement.
Yes.
We wouldn't expect those to naturally just appear in the universe, but yet we expect them to be quantum. So
this
what
is
does this say about quantum computation?
It says that quantum computation could be a way to falsify quantum mechanics or falsify this idea. I like that it's vulnerable. I'd much rather invent ideas that are vulnerable to experimental falsification than ideas where you can just wave your hand and say, but because there's a large number of universes, I'm exempt from science. And I'd be happy to engage in, I'm not much good as an experimentalist, but if I can help somebody design an experiment to falsify this idea, I'd be very happy to.
Okay. I guess it was very interesting, several of the things you said here, especially the blah, blah, blah. But one thing that it comes down to, I think, is you start with this idea of the similarity of the conditions under which what I would say the quantum states are prepared. And wouldn't it be very important to consider how these conditions actually are implemented, how it comes about that the different systems actually get into a quantum state? So I'd say that the state preparation problem is very central in this theory, and perhaps not solved.
I agree totally. And I've given some thought to that, but I have nothing to say worth presenting. I'd be happy to have a conversation about that.
Very good. So I guess we should...
But before, nobody said the obvious science fiction thing?
No.
Okay, anyway, it's obvious, so we... Isn't it?
What is it?
What are you going to do with quantum computers? You're going to talk to other people who invented quantum computers. Far away. Okay. Last question. That's a joke, by the way.
Let me ask. So you're, if I understand correctly, your solution to the measurement problem, I'm trying to put you in perspective. Some people say it invokes consciousness and say once consciousness is there, then you have no superposition. Niels Bohr said the irreversible act of amplification is the one which matters. Penrose invokes the graviton, a difference between two histories. And now you say if there is a little chance that there is such a system elsewhere in the universe from then on. Is that really in the line of these suggestions?
That's the idea.
Wonderful. Let's thank our speaker again.
Thank you.